Civilization, where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.
I'm going to stop there, unusually. Yes. And what I want to do now is just to share with you very briefly something about a gentleman who actually has been coming to this group on and off for nearly 25 years. And so some of you will suddenly go, oh, him! But, of course, Piers is not only somebody with an interest in the unusual, he's also one of the world's best classical musicians. And he is somebody that has got a lot to say about the role of musicians and how, in a challenging world, they actually can offer windows to keep truth alive, to keep beauty alive, and take us to places that maybe other things can't. So we're going to hear tonight not only a presentation, and some talk, but also, I'm sure, some wonderful music. And he will be joined later on by Larry Lush, and they will be playing some of their new album, Dark Side of the Moon, even as the eclipse occurs. And no running out to look at it, all right? You have to look at it in here instead. So, a really big hand, I think, for Mr. Piers Adams.
Dangers of music. I'm just going to pull this up one more time. It's still gone again. The great dangers of music I'll be talking about in a lot of detail, looking at it from lots of different angles, for whom it's dangerous and why, and maybe its great power as well. And the last part, as you heard, we'll be performing from our brand new album. Andy asked me to put this together a year ago for the Glastonbury Symposium last year, and I was reminded of a talk Andy and I mounted together in Lewis many years ago, or Andy mounted it and I took the door money, I think that's how it went, of a man called Peter Taylor, who some of you may well have heard speak. Very interesting man. He's an environmentalist, a climate scientist, and a shaman. I say climate scientist, but he's actually categorised as a climate denier because he has a slightly different view from the mainstream. And this is a very fascinating talk in which he talks about his scientific view of this very contentious subject. But he particularly focused on the control aspect, how whatever one thinks of man-made climate change, it's undoubtedly being used to control us. And he went into a lot of detail about how this happens. And it's kind of quite hard-hitting. And afterwards I talked to him a bit and said, it's quite disempowering to hear all this stuff and to see the scale of the control that's invested on us. And, you know, it's hard to know what to do about it. What can we do about it? And he said, really, the one single most important thing that we have is music. This came from a scientist. So I thought it was really interesting, and this kept me, this sort of got me thinking about this talk and this idea that music is something really powerful that can maybe break through some of the control system. So that's going to be one of the themes of the talk, and I'm going to start here with this quote. Beware of artists. They mix with all classes of society and are therefore the most dangerous. So musicians, of course, we're going to include in that. This was said by King Leopold of Belgium in some correspondence with Queen Victoria. It was later attributed to McCarthy, but that he wasn't the originator of it. And very interesting, this idea of the fact that we might be in danger to particularly the ruling classes. And it's not just the social status, of course, it's the actual raw material that we work with. But this is something that the royals certainly seem to want to have a bit of, in the same way they might want a bit of arcane knowledge of different types. They want a bit of what we musicians have to offer. And throughout history, musicians have been like pets, kept in the courts of the monarchy. And back in the olden days, for instance, the court musicians might have to play the king to sleep, actually in his bedchamber, or sometimes through a series of kind of tunnels which would acoustically bring the music into his bedchamber so he could sleep to drift off to the sound of lovely music. Musicians have this platform, I suppose. They're able to speak both to the royalty and to the unwashed masses in Glastonbury and so on, and everything in between. And this is obviously something which they consider is quite dangerous. I've played to royalty, I should say. I'm going to name drop very, very briefly. I did, about 15 or 20 years ago, I did two concerts in Holyrood, private concerts, one to Prince Charles and one to his dad. And I spoke to the Duke of Edinburgh afterwards, and I was so tempted to ask him some leading question about reptiles. I managed to hold my tongue just about. We ended up having a random conversation about how not to get your arm wet in a shower in a hotel when you turn it on, and that's the famous part of it. The end of that story. Yes, musicians and royalty. Now, musicians actually, well, there's something about musicians, isn't there? There's an old saying, everyone wants to know a musician, but nobody wants their daughter to marry one. And I think there's a lot of truth in that, maybe because we don't fit into society for various reasons, I'm going to come to in a second. My ex-partner, Julia, who's a violinist who used to play blind ball quite a lot, she said, oh, you just want to look at the difference between the two car parks, the one for the artists and the one for the visitors. And one is like a sort of Rolls-Royce showroom and the other's more like a scrap heap. And that sort of shows the difference in status. But there's a reason for this, a reason that we're okay with this. And I'm going to read this to you, got it up there, but this comes from, it comes from a writer from the Los Angeles Times called David Ackert. And this kind of tells you a lot about the content of the talk I'm going to give. Musicians are some of the most driven and courageous people on the face of the earth. They deal with more day-to-day rejection in one year than most people do in a lifetime. Every day they face the financial challenge of living a freelance lifestyle, the disrespect of people who think they should get real jobs, and their own fear that they'll never work again. Every day they have to ignore the possibility that the vision that they dedicated their lives to is a pipe dream. With every note, they stretch themselves emotionally and physically, risking criticism and judgment. With every passing year, many of them watch as the other people their age achieve the predictable milestones of normal life, the car, the family, the house, the nest egg. Why? Because musicians are willing to give their entire lives to a moment, to that melody, that lyric, that chord, or that interpretation that will stir the audience's soul. Musicians are beings who have tasted life's nectar in that crystal moment when they poured out their creative spirit and touched another's heart. In that instant, they're as close to magic, God, and perfection as anyone could ever be, and in their own hearts, they know that to dedicate themselves to that moment is worth 1,000 lifetimes. So that pretty much sums up what this sort of secret is. We don't fit into society, and we have some kind of magic nectar that we hold and can use. Now, musicians, for this reason, because they can get through to such a wide audience, can be a danger to many people. for instance, politicians and leaders, of course, the global elite, whoever they may be, capitalists, educationists, it's something I'll come to towards the end of the talk, religions, music's very dangerous to many religions, of course, many forms of music are banned in many fundamentalist regimes, but it's also dangerous to atheists and rationalists, left-brain thinkers, because music contains something ineffable and numinous that you can't put your finger on and you can't define, and they're going to be talking about that. So, sometimes musicians, because we have this this platform, and we maybe know a few secrets, sometimes musicians become a bit too much of a danger, in which case this kind of thing can happen. Or maybe this, who knows. And this is often one of the problems of having a voice and actually using it. Many musicians have met untimely deaths, obviously many of them coincidental, but some of them may be a little bit more suspicious than that. Or if not that, then this can happen. Which is possibly slightly worse. And more. Yeah. Or even worse, you're going to love this one. Look at the teeth. I'll leave that with you for a moment. So, you know, the anti-establishment heroes become part of the establishment. If they can't absorb them, then they often do away with them or find other ways. This is to say in many walks of life, they do away with them or find other ways to contain them. But the thing about the musician, the true musician, is a trickster. Now, you may have heard of the concept of the trickster. So a trickster is a character in a story who exhibits a great degree of intellectual secret knowledge and uses it to play tricks or otherwise disobey normal rules and conventional behaviour. A boundary crosser, the trickster crosses and often breaks both physical and societal rules. Tricksters violate principles of social and natural order, playfully disrupting normal life and then re-establishing it on a new basis. The trickster is very, very important in life. We need them now more than ever before with the way that we are being controlled. So tricksters need to rise up and use all kinds of trickery. Hermes, in Greek mythology, used the divine trickster, and he could move freely between the different worlds. We live in a time when everything's put in boxes, you know, so to have this kind of free movement is really, really important. Someone once said the idea of Hermes being discussed, the idea that when you're having a conversation, and the subject is moving very effortlessly and freely between very deep and spiritual and obscene and filthy and extremely humorous, and you have that whole kind of mix that's going on, that moment you can say you're channeling Hermes. Hermes is in the room. So this is something that as musicians we try to do. It kind of confuses the mind. Now, the trickster kind of doesn't like pinning things down, and in particular doesn't like what we call binary arguments. Now, we all know about this, where we're presented two options, we're presented two opinions, you're allowed to have one or the other, left or right, you read The Guardian or The Daily Mail, you're in or out, Brexit, you're religious or you're atheist, you know, everyone's kind of channeled as far as possible into two different directions, and I think the role of the trickster is to really challenge that and shine different lights. Some of you may have heard of this book. Anyone read this? Schumacher, he who wrote Small is Beautiful and started the whole Green Movement. This is a kind of philosophical text. It's very, very interesting, a guide for the perplexed. And in this book, one of the things he talks about in some detail is the idea of convergent and divergent problems. Convergent problems, they're problems that tend to converge to a simple solution. He gives the example of designing a bicycle, where eventually you'll turn up with something absolutely perfect, and you can't really get any better than that. Divergent problems, no matter how much you argue one way or the other, you're never going to meet. And he said, writer said, emotionally the type freedom versus order, so freedom versus equality in politics and freedom versus discipline in education. And he says that in order to resolve these kind of issues, you have to recognise the difference between convergent and divergent, but in order to resolve these sorts of issues, you need to transcend them in some way. And so it's actually a process where we sort of raise ourselves as humans. He gives the example of a school teacher If you take the education example, free education versus prescribed, authoritarian, fact-driven system, then a school teacher who's been a very, very good teacher, that sort of teacher that you still remember years on from your childhood, is a big influence. You ask him or her what their opinion is about free or authoritarian education, and they'll say, I don't know, you just got to learn to love the little buggers. That's a, you probably wouldn't say buggers these days, but that was in the 1960s. So that's kind of how we raise ourselves up and shine a different light on these kind of issues. So, you know, we get these any discussion in the press about big topics, evolution, the cosmos, you know, that you'll have Richard Dawkins on one hand and the Archbishop of Canterbury on the other hand arguing, you know, and we need other people who think in an oblique way. Rupert Sheldrake would be a good person to come into that argument and give us a whole different perspective, for instance. So these kind of tricksters we need. When I think of the archetypal trickster at the moment, maybe a little bit less so these days, but certainly a few years ago, I think of Russell Brand, because he's that very sort of tricksterous character, isn't he? And he's got that very quick mind and intellect. He can run rings around people verbally, but he comes from a spiritual perspective as well, and he's also very, very funny and pretty filthy. And that kind of whole combination, I think, is the archetype of today's trickster and what we need a lot more of. So I'm going to talk a little bit about my own experiences in music here. So I have a group called Red Priest. There, there we are. Baroque tricksters, maybe. So we've I'm going to tell you a little bit, illustrate about how this plays out in music. Because even within music, of course, what happens is we get all the rules tend to come in, and it divides up into the same hierarchies as any other society. To give you a little bit of background about Baroque and early music performance, for those of you who don't know, music pre sort of 1750, thereabouts, there was a very different way of performing in those days, and it was only during the late 18th and 19th century that this formalised style of classical music, I'm talking classical music, this formalised style of performance came into being, where you had the great glittering soloist, a big hierarchy between the soloist and the orchestra, in the audience, and the orchestra actually. The whole thing was laid out in a hierarchical fashion. And music became quite separate from people. People used to make music, and then it was like the fashionable thing to go and watch these greats perform. It was a society thing to go to the opera, dress up, and so on. And in the course of that, a lot of humanity was lost. And I think this carried on really for a long time. I'm going to talk a little bit more about the history of music later. But by the time we got into the 20th century, classical music had become established as something completely separate from the normal people's lives. And it was a bit of a club. You either were in it or you weren't. And if you were in it, you knew to go and sit in lines in the concert hall and clap at the right moments. And if you weren't, you probably didn't have anything to do with it. The rediscovery of early music was, in a sense, a way of getting rid of all of those layers of rules and trying to find something a bit more human, which was how music used to be performed in the olden days. And this went on in the 1960s particularly. It was in the days of flower power. There was also a number of pioneering musicians, particularly on the continent, particularly in Amsterdam, who were rediscovering these old techniques and philosophies of early music performance, and bringing that music back to life. And suddenly, it's like all the mists are clear, and you could actually, there was kind of real communication going on in the music. To give one example, for instance, one tiny example, the use of vibrato, the wobbling sound on the notes. If you hear a classical opera singer these days, you hear, "Warr," I can't make the sound, thank God. But, sorry, any singers here? Somebody even asked that. It's a particular sound where vibrato is plastered onto a note, and it turns into a kind of artifice, whereas before that period it was used much more like a modern day pop or folk singer would use it. So it's much more kind of human. That's one example of very many. So these are all being rediscovered, but of course what happened, it threw away the rule book and replaced it with another rule book. and the next rule book basically looked at all of the old texts, looked at what the composers said, and said, right, we better now adhere to these rules, so we do it exactly as Bach or Vivaldi would have done it. We now have to copy that exactly. And so the whole thing became just as tightly bound as it was before, different set of rules. So that's where we came along, and one or two other groups, we decided we weren't going to go with that, so we really looked at the spirit and then threw away all the rules and did really whatever we wanted with the music. And confused people. So it's kind of like a bit like Hermes, as I was talking about. We tried to move between the humorous and the divine and the erotic in our interpretations, and we tried to always avoid categorization. So that's been my career for the last 20-odd years, touring with this bunch of loonies. And it's worth remembering, when we look back at history, you know, we look back at it like looking down at telescope the wrong way, it becomes very small somehow. And we got to see it just like nowadays. We got to see people with the same. There were tricksters then, just as there are now. There was all such a range of people. We tend to sort of narrow it down, box it up, and say this is how people were, this is how musicians were. But to give you some examples of how people at the time thought about, for instance, musical rules. This comes from a musician and writer called Matheson in 1720. Concerning such would-be luminaries who believe music has to follow their rules, when in truth their rules have to follow the music, one can rightly say they manage their thinking to understand nothing. All rules are valid as long as I consider it well and sensible to abide by them. They're valid no longer than that. The rule of nature is in music nothing but the ear, and rules are what I like and as long as I like it. So this is very useful. This is being said at the time. And there's a report, actually, amateur musician and writer, travelled around Europe and heard lots of music being performed and wrote journals about it. It's called Uffenbach, Christoph Uffenbach. And he went to hear Vivaldi playing the violin in Venice. And he basically panned him. He said he played far too fast, and the effect was very unpleasant and a bit frightening. But nowadays, we get panned if you play Vivaldi too fast. So it just goes to show how insidious all this rule-making is, and it doesn't really have any particular basis in any kind of truth. Anyway, moving on. So here are some of the dangers of music, dangerous to some people. So it encourages creative, expansive thinking, it promotes left-right brain harmony, it can point us to mystical, numinous realms, it can produce tricks as the rule-breakers, it can connect people as one, powerful emotions in large groups of people, rouse people to protest and change, and give voice to non-establishment heroes with a large following. So this is really what I'm talking about, the dangers of music and musicians. I mentioned the left brain, right brain thing. This is, I'm sure we all know about the differences between left and right brain, but you can get an idea from these. Music is, of course, something which is a perfect amalgamation of the two lobes. Perfect amalgamation of imagination and kind of work, I suppose. I'll be talking about it in quite a lot of detail later. But it's particularly good at developing the right brain. And I'm going to be talking about this in terms of relation, in terms of education. There's an interesting book which some of you may. Has anyone ever seen this book? Left in the Dark. Strongly recommended. Very, very unusual book. Sorry, you can't see who it's by. It's by Graham Ginn and Tony Wright. But it's all about the left and right brains. And he talks about, from a complex biochemical point of view, when we descended from being apes, we moved from a fruit-based diet via a grain-based diet into our current meat and omnivorous diet. And in the process of that, our brain's biochemistry changed. I'm praising a lot here, I didn't understand it all. And that had the effect of basically making our left brains the dominant part of us, almost shutting down the right brain. The right brain doesn't get much of a look in. The left brain takes over. It's like the robots of the world. Because the left brain is only really meant to be a kind of computer, a calculator, to perform our tasks for us. The right brain is where all the interesting stuff happens and where the knowledge happens on a much more profound level. And he gives some examples of people who have had, for instance, left brain damage. and so their left brains aren't working, and suddenly they're able to perform miraculous tasks, like, for instance, learn a language in a day, that kind of level of ridiculous, because our left brains tend to get in the way. Now, you know, we very much live in a left brain society, and we're told that that's the way forward. And there may be something deliberate to this, as I'll come to you later. But for now, I wanted to talk about music in different ways, both the physical and the non-physical aspects of it, to try and get as far in as we can to what this is all about, without going into clichés, I hope. So there we have all the physical, some of the physical aspects, and at the bottom, the performance of transformation would be the more subtle aspects. So music, to start off, is a sound, a musical note, is just a vibration. If you pluck a string from a guitar, the air vibrates, a standing wave sets up, enters your eardrum, and you interpret it as a pitch. Now, I would say that when that note is transmitted from a musician, that musician is transmitting not only the physical energy of the note, but also a much more subtle energy of the musician's intent, possibly something emotional, maybe even something spiritual, is being packaged up in that waveform and sent to the audience. And so these are sort of the two aspects. I want to separate them out and look at them both in some detail. So the physical aspect, first of all, the waveforms. Now, if you pluck a string, you obviously get, well, first and foremost, you get the fundamental. If you pluck a string, the whole string vibrates and you get the note. If you stop it in the middle, you'll get a note an octave higher. Now, I don't know what level of musical knowledge, it's probably very basic to many of you, but just in case not. So the wavelength proportion between a note and a note, an octave higher, is simply a half. And this is a basic fact of physics. So if you take a recorder, take a note, and that's the same note, and it's very bad, the out of tune octave there. Actually, I can't tell you, I'm going to talk about tuning in a minute, so I won't talk about it now. If you pluck it a third of the way along, you get the note which is an octave and a fifth. So an octave goes from one, say, a C up to the next C, up a fifth to a G. This is a little confusing, I have to say, because I'm talking about fractions in two different ways. So first of all, fractions of the string. That's another way to talk about it. Fractions of how far along you've stopped your string. But I'm also talking about the fractions of the octaves. So between a C and the next C, seven note, and then back to where you started. So fifth note, that's called the fifth. So that's just very basic music there. And so a third, it's a third note, and a fourth, a sixth, a seventh, and the octave. So when you stop it a third of the way along, as I said, you get a fifth. Make sense? No? When you stop it a quarter of the way on, you actually get the next octave, so you've got two octaves. When you stop it a fifth, you get an octave, two octaves and a third. This is all. I'm going to move on here, actually, so you can see this. Anyone who has any interest in music, if you go up here, the bass note there, and you go up higher. Basically, you keep stopping it in whole note fractions. You stop your string more and more, fifth, and sixth, and seventh, and eighth, and ninth, and tenth, and then so on, all the way up, and you pluck a little bit left at the top. That note will keep going up in pitch. Obviously, it's going to get very, very high, but if you bring it back down into the same octave, just by doubling the wavelength, you can bring them all back down into the octave you started with. And what you get, amazingly enough, is all the notes off the scale. These are it's an entirely physical property of nature. So those notes that we're used to hearing and everything don't come from nowhere. They come from actual whole note fraction or whole fractions. In fact, you can produce all 12 notes of the chromatic scale. So not this is a major scale. The chromatic scale has 12 notes. So all of those, eventually, you produce just with this. It's called the harmonic series, and it's how. In fact, you can hear the notes of a harmonic series. Just I'll take a bass recorder. It's got good rich harmonics, but on the bottom note. if I spit it a bit. You can hear all of the other harmonics ringing out, as well as your fundamental note, which is the main note, all from the same length of tube. And in fact, harmonics ring out simultaneously, so when you pluck a string, you hear both the fundamental, but you also, all of those other fractions are ringing simultaneously. And so you get a very rich sound. You're not necessarily aware of it, you'll probably mostly just hear the fundamental note, but actually your ear is also picking up all of these harmonics. And if you only have the fundamental, it would be a sine wave. If you ever hear a sine wave generator, just that computer sound that's completely and utterly flat, that's a sine wave. That has no harmonics in it. But as soon as you play a real instrument, all of these other rich sounds sort of appear by magic. And again, the interesting, I keep going back to the fact that this is all actual physics, it's actual fractions, the kind of very important. So the intervals, again, just very, very going up the scale, unison would be the same note. This will not sound like the same note, but if you go up a minor second, but those are called the intervals, how far between one note and the next. Some intervals have very elegant fractions. An octave is just 2 to 1, as I said. The wavelength is half. A fifth, perfect fifth, is 3 to 2. So that means if you've got two instruments playing a perfectly tuned fifth, this might take me a second to tune this fifth. I'm going to see if I can do it. Not too bad. You can hear when it comes into tune. If I play it slightly out of tune, slightly ugly sound, can you hear when it sort of becomes clean and clear? So we see, we like this sort of order. So once it's slightly, when it's slightly out of tune, then it's an interference pattern and it's messy. A bit like you drop two pebbles in a pond, just not exactly at the same time. You get all kinds of horrible ripples set up. Well, this is similar if you've got two notes that are slightly detuned. So tuning happens by listening for what these call these beats, which is when it's out of tune, and then tweaking one or other instrument till one or other notes till they come into tune. You'll notice there that some fractions are very nice and pure, like a third and a sixth and a sixth and a fifth and a fourth and a third. They all have relatively small fractions, and it's much easier to hear when they're in tune. But intervals like a minor second, which have a horrible 16 to 15. Not a nice sound. So, in fact, the biggest fraction of all, you see, is called the augmented fourth, which is also known as the tritone, is also known as the diminished fifth. But it's the difference between this note, and this was known. Again, it's very unsettling to the ear. And it was known as the devil's interval. For a long time it has been known as that. And it was used, often used to depict the devil, like there's the beginning of Dance Macabre. In fact, I don't know if any of you live in Lewis, but there used to be a Safeway where there's now a Waitrose. And I always remember that because the sound that the items made as they went past the scanning machine was. And that was going on in Safeways all day, every day, so I'm convinced it was some kind of Illuminati organisation. So this produces, as I say, this harmonic series produces this particular pattern of note. All of these notes that we use, and they're used throughout all of music throughout the world. And it's called the diatonic scale. You'll hear that term used. And in fact, the earliest example, possibly, of a diatonic scale being used comes from a bone from about 45,000 years ago. they discovered a bone from that period in history with a few holes cut in it, and they appeared to be in a place that would suggest that even those absolute primitives were playing a diatonic scale. But certainly by the time of this, I don't know how many of you read fluent Sumerian hieroglyphics, but you know, obviously, that depicts a diatonic scale, apparently. Now, the harmonic series is closely related to the Fibonacci sequence, which, as I'm sure you know, is the sort of basic building block of everything in nature. And the harmonic series also reflects throughout the cosmos. And you see these same fractions coming up again and again. And there was an astronomer called Bode in the 1770s who invented his own law there, by which he predicted where Pluto would be found there. And he was extremely close to where it was actually eventually found. And this was simply based on applying the harmonic series to the distances of the planets from the Sun. His theory was then, when he discovered Neptune didn't fit, and that slightly put the kibosh on his theory, but it definitely seemed to apply much more often than not. David Byrne of Talking Heads wrote a very wonderful book called How Music Works, which is part autobiographical, but also some pretty interesting and deep stuff along the lines of things I'm talking about today. And he talks about this. In fact, I think this illustration comes from his book. And he talks about how the sort of first few planets out from the Sun actually seem to fit the same ratio as the dominant seventh chord. And so he said it's a bit like the universe plays the blues. And so on. So that's, yeah, quite a nice way of looking at it. NASA actually produced a series of CDs back in the 80s, I think, called Symphony of the Planets, in which they took the actual orbits of the planets and they somehow took this down to oral frequency and recorded it on some sort of synthesizer and released it. And there's several of them, and they sound like kind of ambient drones, slightly strange sounds, but they were quite popular for a while. Pythagoras used to talk about music of the spheres. This is in Pythagoras' day. Then we had a flat Earth, which we seem to be getting back again now, and a series of concentric spheres around it, which represented the layers of the heavens. And the sound of them moving against each other produced this divine ethereal music, of which all earthly music would only ever attempt to recreate. So it's all along the same lines. Now, Pythagoras actually also, I said I was going to talk a little bit about tuning, and he had a system of tuning. Now, I think I need to go into a bit of detail here, actually. If anyone here ever tried tuning a keyboard instrument without any prior knowledge, because I did that when I was 16, I got a little mini harpsichord, a spinet. And I set about tuning, knowing that you could create a perfect fifth. You simply got your fifths, as I said, nicely in tune. Lovely. Got your fifth in tune, and then you went down the octave, and then you tuned up another fifth, and then up another fifth, and down an octave, another fifth. You kept going round and round your cycle of fifths. You got a lovely, nice, pure, every fifth sounded beautiful. And then eventually you get back to where you started from. You go around all 12 keys and get back to where you started from. And unfortunately, I discovered to my horror the notes are completely different. So I didn't know why that was. They were really sounding wildly out of tune. So I went around and did it again, got the same result. And this is because the mathematics, you would think the universe was perfect. You'd think we had all these lovely perfect intervals, and they all add up in a perfect form to a perfect octave and a couple of keys, but unfortunately they don't. And this is the math, if anyone's interested. The circle of fifths and n-harmonic change. The fraction at the top, 12 fifths divided by 7 octaves, equals 1.0136. It should equal 1, according to what I thought at the time. And so that means that when you get back to the start, you've got an inherent fault built in. to the very physics of the situation, which is interesting. And Pythagorean tuning involves doing pretty much exactly what I did on that spinet. You tune up in fifth, you tune down in fifth, you meet at some obscure key in the middle where you're wildly out of tune, but you don't have any music that goes anywhere near that key. You just keep to a couple of keys where it all sounds lovely and pure. And that was how the very ancient music was. But as time went on, music developed. For better or for worse, it developed, and composers wanted to be able to go into more and more different keys, create more and more effects. And so this Pythagorean tuning no longer worked. And in the Renaissance times, they developed a thing called mean tone, whereby that little bit, that little fold, that 0.0136, which is known as the Pythagorean comma, or the wolf, was divided up. So it didn't all come in one key, but it equally divided between maybe four relatively obscure keys you probably weren't going to go very near. And then the rest would be nicely in tune. But you could go a bit further that way. And most Renaissance music was performed in mean tone, quarter comma mean tone, that's called. And it can produce some very wonderful sound. You listen to Renaissance choral music, for instance, or consort music, and you can have these wonderfully tuned chords which have an amazing effect on the ears. But it comes at a cost. You can only stay in a few keys. So later on, as music developed further throughout the Baroque period, they had to work out even more ways of dividing it up more cleverly, and then all kinds of tuning systems, or temperaments, as they're called, were developed. Until finally, by the time of J.S. Bach, he suddenly came up with his idea of the well-tempered clavier, which is basically equal temperament, which is what we have nowadays. So every single note of the 12 is detuned to exactly the same amount. So no interval is perfectly in tune, but they're all much the same. They're all exactly the same. So if you play a piano nowadays, every single interval on that piano is ever so slightly out of tune. Interesting. We got used to this. I think we've definitely lost something in the process, but we haven't realised we have. Now, one other subject I want to just touch on is the subject of pitch. The sort of starting, obviously I'll talk about relative tuning here between two different notes, but what you choose as your starting pitch is an interesting little sideshow. Pitch has varied a lot. Currently, the starting pitch is defined as note A is 440 Hz in frequency. It used to be quite a bit lower, about a semitone or more lower back in the Baroque period. It's been higher too. On the continent now, it's 442 or 443. But 440 is sort of the standard in this country. There is an argument that the pitch of 432 would be much better. And in fact, that was the pitch that for about 100 years we had that pitch throughout Europe, throughout the time of Mozart and Beethoven and so on. And some people, I know nothing about this, I'm only going to throw it to you, if you want to research it, then do. Some people think that pitch of, the frequency of 432 Hz resonates with our cellular structure in some wonderful and arcane way. And is much more harmonious to listen to. And there is even a theory that it was Hitler who winched the pitch up in order to make everybody feel slightly tense and uncomfortable. That was a little bit about the physical side of music itself. I also want to talk a little bit about sort of how music structurally kind of developed from its early days. One thing I should say, music's all about suspension and release. So you have this idea, when a note's out of tune and then you get it in tune, it sort of goes from tense to, it's nice, you can relax. And music all built on this idea of tension and release, whether it's going from a discordant note to a concordant one, and so on, you get... in one way or another, this seems to be what it's all about. But the most simple form of this is where you have a drone, and a lot of the early music is over a drone. And this means that, doesn't matter, I don't need it for the moment, actually. Over a drone, this means that you have a constant note, or maybe a constant fifth, and over that a melody weaves. And so you're always going on departing from the note, but sort of returning to it. It's always there. And I think we'll have a go at this. I'm actually going to play piece of music, you can be my drone. So I'll play it on this very old type of recorder called a Gems horn. So if this half of the room could hum this note, keep it up, good. This half is there. And I'll just play it a bit. Theory here that there's some correlation between this type of music, which carries on throughout indigenous cultures to this day. Many different musics have the drone at the centre of it. I mean, the Scottish bagpipe music, you've got the chanter making the drone. I have a theory that the drone has some sort of representation with something universal, like universal unconscious, something spiritual in all of us, and it's a kind of oral representation of that. And our lives go, whoa, up there, and they go down there. But then they've always got this reference point in the middle. And that's why I think this music is very powerful. It gives us that internal reference point. One of the most complex uses of drone music that carries on to these days is in India. And it's a very complex art. But you can really hear it, the sound of the drone. In this case, there's a few notes of drone. And the way the way the music weaves around it, I don't think it's going to work. Oh, we don't have sound, do we, Larry, at this?
No.
Oh, thanks. And I can use sound somehow, no, I can't, can I? No, okay. We'll have to leave that one, but I have to talk about it. Anyway, go and listen to some Indian music, you'll hear that. It's a very, very lovely sound. Yeah, Allegri Miserere. This is one of the most gorgeous pieces of choral music. So after the drone music, the next stage was moving into the state of sort of tonality, whereby you have a home key and the music returns to that home key, but it goes away from it. You don't have a constant note going all the way through, so you might start in G major and then go through D major and C major and maybe a couple of minor keys and back to G at the end. So you have a feeling of a journey, but you're going back to where you started from. Within the context of that, you might get a lot of this suspension and release, and it's a shame you can't hear this because it's
I've got a couple of small speakers I could pick it, but
yeah. I can plug it over if you want.
How long will that take?
Almost instant
thing. Oh, you could have told me that while you're sitting there. sitting there. Larry loves everybody. What would you have to do? I'll bring it over. Back to the raga first. See if we get any sound. I went far too far along the track. So I've got to get back to the beginning. Sorry about this. See my technical incompetence here. Here we go. That's the sound I wanted.
Thank you.
Well, I hope that's enough just to get a feeling for that particular sound, that lovely scented, warm sound. So, as I said, so we get on to this tonal music, and this became something slightly different. You no longer have that centre within your own being. Suddenly you're off on a journey somewhere. And this was particularly taken up and used to great effect by the church, the Christian church, who realised maybe that it has a sort of a slight feeling of making you feel rather small. And so it's no coincidence that you go into a cathedral and you hear something like this and you suddenly feel extremely holy. It remained within the walls of the Vatican. It was never allowed out until, reputedly, a young Mozart, aged about six or something, was taken on a visit to the Vatican by his parents. He went and heard this piece of music, came out and wrote it out straight away from memory. So that's apparently how it actually got out in the first place. But you can see it has such a power over people, and I think this music does have a power over us. I'm not convinced it's an entirely good power, but I think it does hold us in thrall and makes us feel small. So that's just my theory anyway. So then after the Renaissance period, tonality continues to develop, you move into the Baroque period, and at this time the Baroque's kind of the era of the trickster, I think. Music went into all kinds of wild and wonderful directions, and it sort of felt a lot less bound than it did in the Renaissance, in which a lot of music was religious, had a sort of very strong functional element. Suddenly music, abstract music, it's a bit like Hermes, has suddenly entered the scene at that point. I think just to break things up, if you heard me droning on, I'm going to play another piece of music now. So this is a little Baroque recorded piece, and like much music inspired by nature, it's called the English Nightingale. Thank you. the Baroque period, tonality continued to develop even more, but more and more stretched into more and more different keys. Got really tortured by the end of the 19th century until it finally broke down at the beginning of the 20th, and suddenly we have the atonal or the 12-tone system of music, whereby every note of those 12 notes on the chromatic scale is assigned equal importance. You can start on one and you can end on another completely different one, and it doesn't matter at all. Kind of, it's a sort of form of equality, I guess, but it leaves you feeling completely alienated. Suddenly you have no home to go to at all. And people understandably ripped up their seats when Stravinsky's Dryden Spring was first performed. But we kind of became used to it, and I think it's no coincidence that in this era of where our serious music has gone in that direction, that we have, you know, two major world wars, time of great strife. I think the two are intimately connected. Even Plato said that the music intimately affects a society as well as reflects it. So that's a interesting development. And that kind of got even more crazy, and it ended up with the music of, for instance, John Cage, his famous 4 minutes 32 of Total Silence. There's even a heavy metal version of this on the internet, you can look it up. I think he's doing a version in Red Priest, maybe a 2 minute 31 or something, an interpretation. So I have to turn this thing on again. Apologies for this constant. So music, yeah, and then it sort of completely fell apart, and we got the kind of avant-garde movement, what we call squeaky gates music. In fact, we've got time, I might just give you an instance of this as well, having just played a bird piece from the 17th century. I'll play a 20th bird piece from 1968 called Music for a Bird. The main backlash, of course, against classical music, serious music going like this, was the growth of all forms of popular music, rightly so. as a complete rebellion against this. And also, actually, the early music movement I talked about a while ago, looking back at earlier times when music had more spiritual connection and meaning. So quickly, I'm going to go to this slide. This is a book with a very boring title, Music, Society, Education. But it's a very interesting thesis. He talks a lot about classical Western music being a total aberration in the sort of long history of humanity, in which we, because we started notating music, we had to keep progressing. So music had to, with this logical result in Squeaky Gate music and John Cage, you know, this is what happens when you write something down, so you can't ever write that again. You have to then move on and do something new all the time. And this is a very much a divergent argument, to go back to Schumacher, whether it's a good thing that we keep progressing or whether actually we should just let music be written and then disappear and never. And that gives us a constant possibility of the creative process happening over and over again, which he argues is what music is all about. And he talks about some cultures where this is exactly what happens. The music is written by a community, it's performed, and then it's thrown aside, and they start all over again. This gives you the possibility to constantly recreate, constantly have the creative process, and constantly create music that is, for want of a better word, harmonious in many different ways. So that's really what I want to say about music itself. I want to talk about the other aspects. So I've kind of talked a little, mostly been talking about the physical aspect of sending that note out to you in all its different ways. I want to talk about the subtle aspect of what's behind that note, or those notes. I'll read you something here from the St. Matheson, who wrote about rules. Both the soul and the intellect are deeply moved by music. What causes this? Surely not just the sound vibrations themselves, nor their shape, size, and figuration, but rather their original and endless combination, variation, application, mixture, character, interweaving, height, depth, stepping, springing, loitering, speeding up, turning, strength, weakness, violence, usual and unusual tempi, softening, slowing down, silence, and a thousand things more which no compass, no ruler, no standard to measure, and none can judge except the noblest, innermost part of the man whom nature and experience have educated. That sort of points a little bit towards these more subtle things that you just can't put your finger on. And I'm going to move on to these two philosophers, Ficino and Castaglione, who wrote a lot in the 16th century, or maybe 1600s, about music and philosophy generally. And they have this concept, again going back to this sort of heavenly celestial music, that the idea of music was to draw the soul out of the body via the ears. Otherwise, one of them wrote, it would be trapped in the muddy vesture of decay. That's your bodies. And Ficino, I've got a little reading from a book called Performance here. Ficino said, the soul receives the sweetest harmonies and numbers through the ears, and by these echoes is reminded and aroused to the divine music which may be heard by the more subtle and penetrating sense of mind. According to the followers of Plato, divine music is twofold. One kind, they say, exists entirely in the eternal mind of God. The second is in the motions and the order of the heavens, by which the heavenly spheres and their orbits make a marvellous harmony. In both of these, our soul took part before it was imprisoned in our bodies. But it uses the ears as messengers, as though they were chinks in the darkness. By the ears, as I've already said, the soul receives the echoes of that incomparable music by which it is led back to the deep and silent memory of the harmony which it previously enjoyed. The whole soul then kindles with desire to fly back to its rightful home so that it may enjoy that true music again. They came up with this sort of threefold approach to performance, which can be applied to all kinds of things in life, actually. It absolutely applies as much to any music, anywhere across the world, anytime, as it did then. And the three sort of parts of it, decoro, which is, in a sense, the left brain part up there. That's your technique, it's your practicing, your study, preparation, seriousness, and so on. And all musicians who are serious about music will have to have some degree of this. And then the second is sprezzatura, nice word, almost onomatopoeic. And sprezzatura, yeah, deliberate nonchalance, improvisation, excitement. Read a little bit from this book, actually. A lightning-like energy which carries courage, boldness, even rashness and excitement. A noble negligence is a quality which cannot be practiced, which returned it back into the realm of decorum. Yet experience, the greatest teacher, may help us to learn to deal with this fiery concept. It's delighting in the moment, a love of improvisation, a kind of calculated carelessness, constantly fresh and responsive to changing moods. It's a sort of buffoonery that has wisdom. That reminds me again of Hermes and the trickster, a buffoon with wisdom. And he goes on to say, you know, if it's such a good thing, why do you even need decorum? Well, of course, otherwise you can end up with a total mess. So we've probably all heard musical performances as just pure technique that leave you cold, but you've probably also heard ones that's full of expression, but pretty shoddy. You know, neither work. So you need the two in tandem. And then, if you do, you might reach this divine state of grazia or grace. And this is something which might, if you're lucky, if you apply decorum spectatura diligently, you might end up producing that state in a room, or to whoever you're listening to, or even to yourself. So it's like the Christian concept of grace, but with a touch of pagan magic to it. And this, in a way, is what that Los Angeles Times writer was describing at the beginning. This is that kind of magic, numinous element where we are all slightly transformed on a level that we don't even understand. This is the old model of the audience and the performer. The performer's in the middle, the audience performing out to the audience, and the audience is hopefully feeding some attention back. But the writer of this book, Anthony Rooley, who's an old colleague of mine, came up with this. Actually, his next one he didn't draw very well, and I'll tell you why in a minute. I think the word performer should apply to this middle circle, not to the bottom one. Here we have the audience, the outer circle, the performers, the inner circle, and they're both tapping into the source of creative energy, which is something beyond all of us. And again, it's a very subtle balance. It's very easy to pin yourself one way or another, but somehow as a musician we have to be open channels, as well as consciously applying those rules of decorum and sprezzatura to everything we do. And this will apply to any, you know, any musician in any field. People do it unconsciously, of course. Some people you can see the ego start shining through. Some people, they're doing a lot, but somehow you're seeing something inside which is completely other. So that's probably as far as I want to go with that aspect. I think just the last little bit of it before we get on to our album launch, just talk about the a slightly, I have to say, conspiratorial point of view, because I can't think how else to look at it when it comes to how music is being sidelined, particularly in education. Does anyone here work in schools?
Used to.
Yeah, used to. Some of you are probably well aware of this. So, there you go. You know, but it's absolutely not. It's completely and utterly relegated as an unimportant, a soft subject. And this is despite so much research. Children's mental health, it is under attack. And how to improve school results, not extra maths, but music and loads of it. And this is really interesting, but this is I actually did a bit up in Stoke-on-Trent, where I went into loads of schools, including one which had been one of the absolute bottom schools in the country, from a very deprived area, very troubled school, but they had turned it around entirely in a year or so, and they'd done it by having something like 8 or 9 hours of compulsory music every week. And because of that, it had a massive transformation effect, and this has happened in loads of schools. So you would think the government would listen to this, and this fits in with research. You know, a lot of academic research comes up with exactly the same thing, but what do we get? We get Michael Gove telling us we have to learn more facts and have much, much less of this. So, you know, either he's a very, very stupid man, or he's a very clever man and he knows what he's doing and he's deliberate. And I'm not sure where I sit on that, but he's not somebody I think can kindly of. He's not in the audience tonight, is he?
I wish he was.
Yeah. But not just him, but he's been the latest in a long line of people who have really not taken this seriously. There's more there. Replacing music programs with reading or maths instruction, may actually lead to deficient skills in other cognitive areas. It's a left brain, right brain thing. It joins the two lobes up. It's important because our right brains are very clever. Our left brain, it's like teaching phonetics in schools. You know, so many people learn, I mean, I learned to read, I don't know about anyone here, I learned to read by my mother showing me flashcards with lots of words on them, and I thought they looked like I knew what the words were, and I could read before I went to school. Nowadays, it's all broken down into sounds, and it's all done in left brain fashion. Lots of kids who go to school able to read find they can't read then for quite a long time until they relearn in a left brain fashion what they've already done in a right brain fashion. So, you know, I'm not an educationist at all, but it seems completely illogical to me, and it seems so illogical that it must be deliberate. And I think that one of the aspects of control is trying to make the left brain the dominant lobe from a very, very early age. So we need to bring back music for children. It's absolutely crucial. So many people say, Simon Rattle there, every child's birth rate to have access to music, essential to the well-being and success of young people, and so on. So there are places where this has happened. Venezuela is a good, you probably won't be able to read all that, you can if you want. Venezuela is a good example where they have a very serious program of classical music called El Sistema, and hundreds of thousands of school children are taught orchestral instruments and network orchestras. It has really transformed the society. It transmits the highest values of solidarity, harmony, mutual compassion, and it has the ability to unite an entire community and to express sublime feelings. But there's always a flip side to everything, you know. Whenever anything comes along, like I said about the early music movement, suddenly it becomes rule-bound in a different way. You know, we all read Animal Farm. This happens over and over again. Every time the mold's broken, it's recast. And so this is just something I took down. But there are some people who say that actually, yes, someone who'd been, he said, yes, it is a model of absolute tyranny. It's a society where someone will always be telling you what to do. It can be organised, of course, because you have someone with lots of power who tells you exactly what to do. And you keep your mouth shut, end of story. So, you know, it's a kind of open question here. Is it possible to actually have creativity without pouncing on it and turning it into another hierarchy? And that's a very difficult question. So, you know, that is one area where it raises my hackles to see that. See that going on. Big corporations continue to control what music we are allowed to hear, and I have a direct example of this. In my group, we managed to break the chart system a year and a half ago with a CD we made called Baroque Bohemians, and we did it because we had a series run of concerts, and we realised that to get high up in the classical charts, you have to sell remarkably few copies, because classical music is virtually dead when it comes to music sales. So if you sell in the hundreds, you'll be well up in the charts. If you get over 1,000, you'll absolutely be number one. And that's across all media, across the entire world in a week. So it's completely different numbers from the pop world. Anyway, we managed to work the system, and we managed, through selling up concerts and putting a few little tricks here and there, we managed to get ourselves into the number one in one of the classical charts, and we got into the Classic FM combined chart. We were number 7 one week, so I listened to the top 10. And everything else was standard classical music, and it was the usual stuff. Big record companies came to us, they played ours, that was great. Next week, we got even higher, we got to number 4, and I listened again. Number 5 was Alistair McGowan playing romantic piano pieces. And they said, and that was Alistair McGowan. Number 4 was Red Priest, so we'll go straight to number 3. And that was it. People play us. So this shows the kind of level of control. Partly a money thing, the big companies basically pay for it. But partly I think that there is a desire to keep classical music is this. If ever you scan through a radio station, I don't know if you have this driver car, you will hear doof, 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 pop music, and you will hear slushy classical orchestral music, 19th century stuff. That's it. You do, when do we hear it again? When do we hear that lovely Indian marvel or anything else that makes us sit up and listen? It's very boxed up. So the need to change that. The internet can really help with that. The internet is, of course, allowing lots of musicians to have careers that are outside of this. But the mainstream media still seems to have quite a stranglehold. And that's probably where the next stage of development is, as long as we have a free internet. And I hope that this will continue to be the case, and we can spread good music and good energy through it. that's kind of all I wanted to say, really, because I wanted to give the last 15, 20 minutes over to the launch of our new album. I'm just going to say a word or two about Larry. I don't need to be setting up here. This is Lawrence Elliott Potter, otherwise known as Mr. Larry Lush. I think very appropriately for this lunar eclipse, just about to start. So I'll tell you a little bit about this album. I actually had this idea about at least 30 years ago I'd listened to quite a bit of sort of synthesized meditation music, gave it every night. And I also loved Baroque music. And I thought there's something about the sort of sound and harmonies of Baroque, particularly slow Baroque pieces, that really would fit with this genre. And so for a long time I wanted to do it. And Larry and I met about, 5 years ago, 6 years ago? I can't remember. A few technical things to sort out here. And I played him some primitive examples of what I was talking about, and he said, great, let's go for it. So the album is all slow music, it's very meditative, it's a real chill out album from beginning to end. This is the first time we've ever attempted to do it live, so you have to bear with us, might be a few technical hitches. We hope to put together a continuous sort of thing for you. You're going to hear basically 3 tracks, and maybe a slight pause in between them all, but maybe just stay still and absorb them all. And they're 2 of them are by Bach, and 1 is by Vivaldi. And the titles are up there on the screen, or some wonderful video footage that Larry's created. Larry was going to pretend to mime on a keyboard, but I think you decided not to, haven't you? Well, there'll be a certain amount of twiddling going on, I'm sure. So this, I'll just say, really, really, this is not like a classical concert. I'd really like you just to chill out and not feel you have to applaud or anything. Just literally sit back and listen and watch one of the videos and let this sound wash over you. magic weather.
Thank you.
so much, both of you. You're a beautiful music and the visuals as well, and your insights, really fantastic. Another round of applause.
Where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.